Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard. I'm here with Nicholas Gilbert. Hey, Nicholas.
Hello.
And it's good. We're in person. We're in person during Omicron. We're both clean. We're both vaccinated and tested. And most of these lately have been on Zoom, but it's kind of fun to look someone in the eye. Nicholas is here to talk about his film Nailed, which is in season 4 of Discover Indie Film, the TV series. I feel rusty. So Nailed was in Filmvasion Los Angeles in June of 2020, and that's when I first got to talk to Nicholas, and we did a Q&A on Zoom because, of course, Filmvasion 2020, June 2020, was the year that COVID hit us. And so Nicholas is going to tell you all about what it was like to finish a film, right? Because you finished before COVID.
Yeah, we were done before the virus hit the world. And we had gotten into a number of festivals at that time, but we hadn't really played in any yet, right? So just as we were coming out, festivals were either going online or pushing or shutting down altogether. So, you know, the virus really did hit our distribution.
Yeah, you just got worked over on that one. But anyhow, it's a great film. I loved it. So we threw it in the Discovery Indie Film TV series, and now we're finally talking. It's been a long time. That came out, season 4 was probably July of 2021, I think.
Yeah, that seems about right.
I think so, yeah. So it's a hilarious film. It's a great film. It's cinematic. I know we're going to talk about a lot of great influences. But all I want to do before we start getting into Nicholas's past is urge everyone to just go watch it. Go to Amazon Prime Video. Go to search for Discover Indie Film. It's in season 4, episode 3. It's $7.99 for a season or 99 cents for just that episode. But it's hilarious. It's playing with hilarious films. The whole season is good. So watch the film because we're probably going to let spoilers go. I don't think there's any way to discuss that film without spoilers.
No, I don't think so.
So please enjoy the film. And now I'll jump into just starting with you, Nicholas. So what got you started? I learned before we started recording that you are from Michigan. You're from Detroit.
That's right. Yep.
So what got you into film?
Well, I say I'm from Detroit, but I'm actually from Ann Arbor. I grew up in Ann Arbor, and I was born in a small town in northern Michigan called Cadillac. But I was lucky enough to leave Cadillac, a city of 10,000 people, when I started high school. But Ann Arbor, where I actually grew up, is you know, only about 45 minutes outside of Detroit. So Detroit was certainly a big influence on me. And you know, I started acting when I was in elementary school and through middle school and a little bit in high school. But luckily enough, you know, in high school, I had some video production classes, and I was a guy that was running around with a video camera, annoying all my friends all the time with a little Sony Hi8 camcorder. And I think those are kind of some early things that just got me interested in production. After college, you know, I stayed in the area and ended up working in the Detroit market for a number of years. Lots of commercials, a lot of auto stuff. People don't think about it, but for a long time, Michigan, Detroit specifically, was the third largest production center in the United States for film. And it really goes back to Ford and the Ford Communication and Photographic Department. You know, they started in, you know, the 20s making all kinds of industrial films and everything. And because of that, you know, there was an independent film community that grew up around that. So I got involved with that, trying to make my own stuff when I was also, you know, working on these television commercials and the occasional feature that would come into town.
And I'm going to make you back up because, so you started playing with the video camera.
Yep.
Which is a great time of life, right? Was that like middle school age or
yeah,
earlier?
My family, my father, even going back to elementary school, you know, we had a VHS, you know, the backpack style video camera that my brother and I would run around with and, you know, make little stop motion Lego animation things and whatnot. I didn't get a Super 8 camera until I was in high school. And that was usually only used for very special projects and things because you actually had to pay for the processing and the developing of the Super 8, which...
Right, you're talking about Super 8
time,
film camera.
Film cameras, yeah. But I also had a Super 8 video camera, and that's what I used much more often, a Sony Hi8 camcorder, and I would have it with me almost all the time.
Yeah, yeah. So you were super into it, and,
totally.
And at that point, were you becoming a film aficionado? Were you into watching as much as
oh yeah
making?
Absolutely. You know, I've always been a huge film buff. You know, I gravitated towards movies early on. You know, actually, maybe I started in television, then went to films, and then stayed with film and independent film and foreign film for a long time before finally in the Netflix era and the golden age, the new golden age of television coming back to it. But I was a film snob for many years. I think one of the reasons is because of growing up in Ann Arbor, we had the Michigan Theater, which was an old 1920s movie palace. And the programming of the Ann Arbor Film Festival is there, right? So I was an usher in high school at that film festival, and I got to see all kinds of great independent stuff that was coming out at the time. And the programming there was really great.
And know? That would have been before the festival explosion, right? That's before.
This would be in the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah. It was. I guess it was the late 80s. It started to happen that every city in America needed a festival. But festivals were rare before that.
They were rare. Yeah. I mean, the Ann Arbor Film Festival, I think, is the longest constantly running film festival in the United States. I could be wrong about that. But if it's not the first, it's one of the earliest.
It's believable. It's a hoity-toity suburb, right? I've driven through Ann Arbor.
Yeah, it's hard to call Ann Arbor a suburb. I mean, the University of Michigan is there.
Right, it's
its own community. And it's very separate and different from the Detroit community. However, it's close enough that you can live in Ann Arbor and work in Detroit, right? Kind of the best of both worlds.
Absolutely. No, I think I've driven through. And I've seen what it's like when you cross whatever mile road it is.
Yeah.
All of a sudden you go from Ann Arbor to Detroit and you're like, how does this exist? It's kind of amazing.
It really is amazing.
And any community near, University of Michigan is like one of the biggest universities in the country.
It is.
It's huge.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that totally affects the art and movie scene.
It does. Absolutely. And the University of Michigan isn't the only university in Ann Arbor. You know, you have Eastern Michigan University, which is right next door in Ypsilanti, a number of smaller community colleges and then private colleges as well. So you know, it's really a kind of an intellectual, artistic place.
Yeah, that must make it rad to be growing up there with artistic and cinematic interests to be around colleges just totally gives you an edge, right? Because like there's always like small films that are brought to colleges and whatnot. College communities, I think, are always sort of little cultural bubbles. It's like a little piece of Soho, right?
Yeah. And it's good and bad. You know, I mean, at a certain point you get where you need to get out of that bubble, right, and go see the real world. But to grow up in that bubble, it was really wonderful. I went to a public high school called Community High School, but it was very, very liberal. The building was actually on the campus of the University of Michigan right downtown. And so on our lunch breaks and between classes, you know, we would always run around and, you know, go explore the town. And we were also allowed to take a lot of university classes. So, you know, in high school, I took a number of university level film classes as well, which I think were pretty influential on me.
Yeah. And that's early. So when you applied to undergrad, were you totally certain you were going to be a film major or did the real world sort of,
well,
was
growing
that?
Up in Ann Arbor, going to high school in Ann Arbor is a lot like going to college in Ann Arbor. So, you know, when I was graduating, I wasn't sure. I knew that I wanted to make films, but I wasn't sure that going, you know, the university or going the film school route was the best thing for me. So I actually kind of took a little bit of time off after high school and then sort of freaked out in my decision making, saying, what am I doing? You know, I should be going to film school. But the way that things were scheduled, I ended up applying to a broadcasting school in Detroit called the Spex Howard School of Broadcast Arts. They changed the name now. I think it's called the Spex Howard School of Media Arts. But it was a year-long program all day, every day for a year, and it was radio and television production. And for half the year, the radio and the TV people are together, and then in the last half of it, they separate them. And I obviously went the television route.
Right, and really practical, hands-on kind of technical
it was.
Training.
Yeah, it wasn't really about filmmaking. You know, it wasn't about making movies or making television. It was more about working for local television stations. You know, how do you work in a newsroom? How do you go out and cover things like that?
That's cool.
But it was the first time that I really got a good introduction to lighting. You know, they had professional tools at it. So like in high school, we learned to edit on, you know, VHS, Sony RM440, you know, linear tape editing.
Yeah, where you have the two decks and the controller
in
between.
Exactly.
Destructive
editing.
I'm just old enough to know these things. Or I'm older. I'm older than Nicholas.
A little bit. Not by much.
Not a ton.
But at the Spex Howard School, you know, they had one of the first Avids, and we actually had a class in it. So it was really great. And they also had the Amiga Video Toaster. I don't know if any of you listeners out there remember that piece of hardware.
Not many people are going to know about a video toaster, but that was huge.
It was a game changer. right? So for the first time, you could actually do moving titles, you know, and have transitions that weren't just cuts. You could do wipes and dissolves. And, you know, it was really just this beginning of computer assisted editing. It was great. So
it was, and Avid was world changing.
Yeah.
That was on, wasn't Avid originally like on those little Macs with like the 7-inch? I remember the first time I saw Avid, it was like on a really ancient Mac.
Yeah, these were probably like Quadra era Macs. But I mean, it had all kinds of back then, you know, you weren't just running it off of your video card, you know, internally. You actually had to have a lot of hardware. And then the huge things with these early Avids was the storage, right?
Oh my God, the drives,
you know, to have like a 2 terabyte drive would be as big as a refrigerator and heavier, you know, and you'd have to like daisy chain a bunch of them together. And they cost like $100,000 for a terabyte.
Yeah, it was totally, yeah, amazing, amazing. That would be an amazing documentary.
Yeah.
About the rise of it, as it was called, offline editing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there were online Avid suites, right?
Yeah.
For sure. People were finishing in Avid, depending on what it was. Not a lot for film, right? Because there was no DI at that point, and, you know, people were still cutting and doing work prints and then answer prints and everything. But you would offline, yeah, digitally, and then go out to your, then send it to the cutting department.
Yeah,
the film
and then
department.
you would have an EDL, right?
That's right.
And you would cut the negative to the EDL,
yep.
Which was, wow, mm-hmm. Just people have no idea how much more expensive it was to make an indie film, even in like the late 80s or early 90s.
Yeah.
There was a million extra costs.
Yep. And then came DV, you know, with the Canon XL1, which is kind of a big stepping stone for
huge,
me.
Huge. And you've been a part of that. So by the way, I was just curious, did it sounded like you took time off between high school and going to that.
Yeah, a few months.
Oh, just months. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah,
it wasn't like you spent a year working at a supermarket.
No, definitely not at all.
Right, you had said no to like going to a standard university, and
I had this idea that everything in high school was this sort of academic education, and there was no practical application to it, right? And so, like, okay, I'm out on my own. I don't want to be living in this world of all theory. And at that time, so much of what I heard about film school was it was all theory. And I was like, you know what? I know that there is this production community in Detroit. I don't really know how to get into it, but I'm going to try because I want to go out there and actually do things. I'm tired of only learning. I want to start applying. But then, like I said, I kind of freaked out and was like, you know what? Maybe I can do both. And if I don't go to college now, maybe I'm never going to go. Right. And so there was that fear. And so, with traditional colleges, you know, it takes a year or whatever for that process to go through where you put in your application and then you have to wait to get, and then you interview or you know, however it works. But with a broadcasting school, they have enrollment at different terms throughout the year. So it was much easier to get into, and it fit the schedule from not having gone through the traditional college application process.
For sure.
And then there was another component to it as well. I was working in this nightclub in Ann Arbor, which was, it was a disco, but we also did some rock and roll stuff, you know, and I started out as a barback, and then I was a busser, then I was a barback, then I was a bartender. And then I started, you know, working with the guys in the DJ booth and kind of worked my way into being the lighting guy. And so, you know, the DJ would be spinning records and I'd be hitting the buttons and kind of doing the disco stage show. And then when we did rock and roll shows, you know, then I would set up the lights on the stage and set up the stage and kind of run all that stuff. Through that, I started working during the day a little bit instead of just at night, you know, to go in and set up everything. Ended up meeting the owner of the business. His name is John Carver. Great guy. And he also owned a video production company called BCI, which stood for Better Communication Incorporated. And he just owned it. He wasn't really active in the running of it. And what the business did was a lot of corporate stuff, a lot of industrial stuff, you know, from the early 90s. You can imagine how exciting it was. So I was their PA, and I would go out on shoots with them. I managed to talk my way into getting a job there, but he wouldn't take me on as a full-time employee until I graduated from this program. So that was another reason why I decided to go and do it. And it was really a great thing to do working at BCI because I actually got to go out and shoot, and it was my first introduction at, you know, 19 years old to the real legitimate film business compared to the stuff that I'd been doing in high school, you know. But I shot more machines and industrial stuff than I did human beings, right? And so it wasn't so much an introduction to story, but it was a good introduction into the technical aspects of filmmaking.
Yeah, into production, and you're still you are still creating a story in a way with that. I mean, I imagine you were just really more on set, but you're still learning about sets and lighting and all kinds of things.
Yeah, and they were really small crews. I mean, it was like a 4-person crew, the director, the DP, like a producer and me, right? And so it's really great to be on those small things because you are handling lights. You know, you're not just a PA locking up sets, you know, in the background.
And I'm sure you're doing everything, and it must be really cool to be young. And by the way, I just feel the need to do the old man thing and say, like, I'm sure people don't get just how theoretical film school programs were in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, that's a good
because,
point.
As we said, any kind of equipment was so expensive.
Huge
that all they could do is
expensive.
Give you books on filmmaking and books on this, and you would just, it was always film studies.
Yep.
Any of this production hands-on stuff just didn't exist in the days of
and it was all film. So even if you could afford the film, so a lot of these film schools had a couple of, you know, Super 8 cameras, you know, or Super 16, you still had to pay for the film yourself and the processing and the development and the transfer of it. And so even if you did get the equipment or somebody donated the equipment to you or whatever, and you would have to buy insurance to get it, you still couldn't pay for very much film stock, right? So it was really a different world.
And by the way, I'll just share this, which totally dates myself. But when I was considering at my best friend's urging, submitting to applying to NYU graduate film school, they required you to submit footage on film.
Great.
If you and I had only done VHS, and this is 1990.
Yeah.
So it's like, just impossible. Like, how are you going to, you just can't pick up a film camera and start shooting film and have it look anything like the stuff you did on video, you know, cutting video, even if you did 3/4 inch, right?
Yeah.
It was just,
yeah, it's a whole different
the
world.
Idea of going to film school was, there's a lot of hoops to jump through.
There were. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the equipment was just unreachable.
Yeah, it really was.
So,
yeah. And it was all, and entrance was all portfolio based. Right. And so not all, I mean, sure they looked at test scores and things too, but you had to submit going in as a high school student, you had to submit a reel, you know, to get into these film schools.
And it had to be a film reel.
Yep.
which there's people who have graduated from NYU last year who have never touched film, probably.
Oh, I'm sure.
Some people do, just for the heck of it, because they're rich kids.
Right.
All right. So back to you.
Yeah. Okay. Continuing the story. So BCI, good, bad. So it was great that I got a job there. Bad, about 3 months after working there, he decided to close the business, which also was a good thing, bad thing. I mean, I'm really glad in retrospect that he closed the business because, you know, I didn't want to get stuck doing this corporate video stuff.
Right.
I'm probably sure. Yeah,
probably
not. I mean, I think I was making $50 a day or something like that. But still, you know, I didn't want to get stuck doing that kind of work. But the good thing about it is I lost my job, but so did everybody else that worked there. And then a couple months of applying to different places and like trying to get jobs at other corporate video places and having no luck, I started freelancing because one of the people that I worked for there got a job on a film that was coming into Detroit starring Claire Danes and Lena Olin called Gabriel Byrne called Polish Wedding. And so she hired me to be a production assistant on that job. And that was my first real sort of film job in the film business, you know, working on a real movie.
Excellent. Excellent. And I guess a question I should have asked a while back is the whole time you get doing a lot of technical stuff, were you fulfilling your creative side at all? Were you writing stuff in your spare time?
I wasn't writing at that point in my life. You know, I always knew that I wanted to write. You know, I wrote a lot, not of screenplays in high school. Most of the stuff that we did was more improvised or treatment based. And I didn't even really learn screenplay writing until, you know, I was in my mid-20s and I started downloading scripts from the internet. So it was really kind of learning, how to direct, learning how to technically make film, but always having an interest in it, but not really knowing how to do it and then
Right. So you were a cinephile, but you weren't writing yet.
I wasn't writing
for
yet.
Film.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Right. I really kind of took a much more technical route in, and I worked for years as, I started working, as a freelance production assistant, from the people that I met on Polish Wedding, and in the commercial market in Detroit. But I also knew that, you know, being a production assistant is great to learn and to observe, but it's just a terrible life and not what I wanted to do at all. So I was always looking for other opportunities to do things. So I started working as a non-union grip and electrician, kind of learned that technical aspects of it. And I also bought a Canon XL1 mini DV camera when they first came out, and then started shooting lots of corporate stuff and little indie things, shot a bunch of short films, and kind of really taught myself the technical aspects and the creative aspects of cinematography as well. As a side note, I also ended up getting into the union as a production designer. And so while I'm doing all of this kind of non-union stuff, I'm also working in the union world as a production designer / prop guy on some bigger commercials and things, getting health insurance and like doing this to survive and then this other stuff to, you know, satisfy myself creatively. And that led to making a film called Trap. So Trap was a mini DV independent feature. I was one of the first producers on it and also the director of photography, but I didn't write it and I didn't direct it. But we were successful in raising about $250,000 and then ended up shooting the film and getting it out there. So it was also my first kind of experience with film festivals, going out, taking it on the road. And, you know, we probably played 10, 15 festivals, not of any prestige, but it did allow us to sell the film. You know, we got a business rep and a sales agent, and we sold it to a company called Lightwave Entertainment. And so it was in every Best Buy and every Walmart for a couple of months, you know, on DVD. And it was on Netflix in the early days of Netflix.
Right, that so was, Netflix existed at that point.
It did. So this movie...
As a streaming service.
Well, you could also get the disc,
yeah.
You know, at that point you could get the disc of Trap, but it was also streaming and it was one of the first indie titles that they streamed. And so we shot it it took years to shoot this film, right? So we ended up raising first like $15,000. We shot all the exteriors of the film because it takes place over a couple of seasons. And so we needed to get the summer stuff before it turned into winter, cut together a trailer, showed that around where it took like another year. So we needed to shoot the exteriors, but then it still ended up taking us another year in order to raise some more money, shot the first like 15 minutes of the film, cut that together with our exterior stuff, created a second trailer. Then we were able to raise enough money to go into production. But we still didn't have enough to finish.
I mean, I'm smiling because these are all really good lessons of indie filmmaking. That's exactly what you need to know. And it sounds like because you were involved in the community, like you knew obviously whoever was writing and directing this stuff, like it sounded like a nice little team formed around this.
It was. Yeah. And so Jim Bonner was the director of the film, and I still work with him quite often. He's not really directing anymore. He still feels like he's in filmmaker's jail, you know, because we didn't make a lot on Trap. But he's kind of reframed himself to be a visual effects guy. And so he does a bunch of computer animation for me on my projects. And actually, he did some of the effect shots on Nailed.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So, yeah, it really was the great beginnings of a good partnership.
Yeah. And you got to go through that experience. That actually is fantastic that Trap got you festival experience, and then what it's like to sell a film is really eye-opening.
Yeah. It was trial by fire. And it took years. Like I said, I mean, we ended up shooting first in, I think, 99 or 2000, like that. And I don't think it was officially released until 2006. So it was a long time. And also, that was one of the things I think that hurt the film. You know, we shot it on mini DV, and we actually, when it was all, we had a cut of the film. You know, the whole idea was to do a film print. Right. Because at this time, nobody was projecting digital, or if they were projecting digital, they were terrible projectors, you know, and it just looked awful and looked really blocky. So we actually tested, you know, transferring it to film and actually have a little film print of the trailer for the film, which I still think is pretty cool. But the rapid change in technology at that time, I think, is one of the things that really hurt the film, because it was mini DV. We actually shot at PAL. At 25 frames rather than 30, because it was much easier to do the reverse 3:2 pull down in order to go to, you know, a digital, or to go to output.
Right,
to film,
right,
from
to
digital.
Output, yeah. Which, by the way, I understand what you're talking about, but I think most people would be like, huh? But yeah, frame rates.
What's frame rates?
How is the frame
right.
rate of Europe?
Right. Well, and it's also fields versus frames. Right, because in TSC footage and PAL, it's interlaced, right? It's 30 frames of 60 fields, right? Whereas film is actually progressive, right? It's just a single frame, you know, 24 per second or 23.98, you know, if it's digital.
And I mean, I assume the festival run, they were showing a physical print.
Correct. Yeah. You're right. And that was the whole reason why we wanted to do the two film transfer, right? But we did shoot it on mini DV, and then which was the way to do it when we started. But by the time we finished, everything had changed, right? So 24P had come out. You know, the Star Wars prequels were out, right? And they were all shot on the new Sinalta, right? And so the technology had radically changed. So the Canon XL1 is a 4x3 chip. Right. And that was acceptable because everybody still had cathode ray tube televisions when we started. By the time we were done, everything was 4:3. Right. And, you know, widescreen TVs and flat panels were starting to come out. So we knew that technology was changing when we shot it. So I always framed it, you know, in 16:9, and then we ended up cropping. But, yeah, you can tell that it's cropped. Right. And then, of course, it's letterboxed, you know, or pillar boxed, depending on what distribution channel.
Yeah. I remember the days of the pan and scan. And debates, and
that's
and,
not a debate. Don't do it.
Don't do it. Yes. Well, what did you do when you went from film to video and back and forth? Yeah, the fact that
it's cropped.
And the time that you shot to the time that you released. Yeah, that was the transition of.
Yep.
That was when home TVs were changing.
It was.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. From 4:3 to 16:9.
Yep. So not only were the acquisition format changing with the technology and the cameras changing, but right, the distribution avenue was changing as well, right? Festivals were starting to be able to project digital prints, right? It didn't have to be film anymore. Yep. Televisions were changing. People were starting to hook up their computers with Windows Media Player, right? And starting to watch stuff.
Windows Media Player and iMovie changed
everything.
A lot of lives.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Up until then, all that stuff was impossible. So Trap really was at a good and difficult time, but you were also in there early enough to get in with a Netflix.
We were, yeah. And that was our sales agent. You know, and you could say that, like, maybe Netflix was taking everything at this time or everything at a certain level, right? Because this was really in the early days of Netflix. That was back when, I don't know if you remember, but in the early days of Netflix streaming, users could actually comment on what they were watching. I don't remember if there was a stars rating system, but you could comment on the films and say, oh, this movie sucks. This movie was terrible. I don't like these characters, or I loved it. Wow, what a great indie effort. And our comments were all over the place, which was really fun to watch for me, you know, just as a producer in the DP, and really tough for Jim to read because, you know, some people were really great about it and then some people were just really brutal and didn't understand. So they think that it should be Star Wars, right? And don't realize that it's a $250,000 movie, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No way to distinguish. Besides that, we didn't really know about Trolls yet.
Right. Yeah.
But those were early Trolls,
those,
right?
Those, that's
that
exactly
was back
what it was.
When I remember my first experience on like a, you know, chat board or a message board of like, you know, young middle school age kids coming across like violent, you know, ridiculously violent, angry people. Like,
yeah.
like that whole thing was emerging.
Because now they have a platform.
Yeah.
But, you know, kudos to Netflix because most people don't even remember that you could comment on movies on Netflix. So luckily it didn't last very long, you know, and now it's their algorithm took over the troll comments.
I remember, I'll tell you later. I'll tell you my Netflix movie experience, but a movie I was involved in was actually on Netflix when it was only discs being mailed home.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I had friends who didn't, I'm telling you the story. I had friends who like, didn't want to give it 5 stars because it would adjust what Netflix
their
was algorithm. Recommending.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And they're like, well, that's a rom-com. It's not, I don't want rom-coms coming
right.
to me. And I was like, oh, come on, man. Give me 5 stars. It's kind of funny.
It's a tough one, right?
It was, and that was back when like you just had 3 discs at a time, right? You just kept mailing them in.
Well, I don't now on Netflix, what it's a thumbs up or thumbs down, right? The more thumbs
that's all
up,
you can do, yeah.
I don't do anything. I never thumbs up anything, and I never thumbs down anything, because frankly, I don't want Netflix telling me what I should be watching. I want to tell Netflix what I want to watch.
And they're sucking in every piece of data they can anyway.
Yeah, they're, God, they already know what I'm going to think anyway. So
they know exactly what we're up to. It's horrible. Well, so cool. So after Trap, you're still in Michigan.
Yeah, I'm still in Michigan. You know, I stopped working in, so I kept shooting things, but I really kind of realized that this was the beginning of my big fish, you know, little pond. I want to be big fish, big pond kind of guy. And so I was still working in the art department because that was giving me my insurance and I was making a bunch of money. But one of the things that I learned from working on Trap was, it's not that I didn't get along with the director. Like I said, I still work with him, but it was really at that point that, I realized that I don't want to be a DP. I have my own stories to tell. I want to tell my own stories and I'm not doing it. And I'm never really going to be doing it as long as I keep working towards being a cinematographer. So, by that time I had, while I was working, I went to a small, liberal arts college outside of Ann Arbor called Siena Heights University and got my bachelor's degree. I could transfer a bunch of my credits in from Specs Howard. And then, so I didn't really have to do that much work in order to finish my degree. So I was able to do it while still working full time in production. But after Trap, I realized that, you know, I really needed to learn how to tell my own stories. So I decided to, get my master's degree. And I got it in at a place called Maine Media College, which is in Rockport, Maine. But it's a really, really great program. They were just starting. I think I was one, like the 20th person to graduate from the program. But it's a low residency program, which was great for me to continue working in production and learn how to be a screenwriter and really hone in on my directing.
Really good at balancing multiple things at once, because whether or not you think you are, yeah, I mean, very few people can keep a career going while continuing their education, and it sounds like you always had an eye on that.
Yeah, but it's taken me 25 years to get to this point, you know. I appreciate the comment for sure.
I mean, it's still true. I mean, for sure. I have an LA centric question.
Sure.
Which is, while you're working on commercials and things and whatnot in the Midwest, in Michigan, are people talking about moving to LA? Like, are there people saying like, hey, are you ever going to like make the switch and try to go?
Sure.
Like, was it sort of, always an idea?
Yeah. So, you know, it was never a question of, am I going to live in LA? It was a question of, when am I going to move to LA?
Right.
And, you know, since right out of high school, essentially I started working in the film business and kind of moved up pretty rapidly on the technical side of it. I never was willing, and probably a fault of my own, you know, if I moved out to LA right out of high school, if I went to film school, you know, my life could have unfolded very differently or maybe at a different pace. Not that I have any regrets. But really, it was never a question of if, it was a question of when. And I didn't want to start over, right? So I had the fear of like, okay, you know, right, I'm shooting things, even if they're music videos and short films. If I go to LA at this point, I'm probably going to be working as a production assistant again, right? Just to survive, right? So it was very carefully planned about when I would move to LA. And so another thing happened in Detroit, and that is our film incentives. So, I can't remember. It must have been like 2008 or something like this. I officially joined Local 600, the Camera Guild. So I stopped doing any sort of art department stuff because now I could get my insurance and things that I needed through the Camera Guild. Although I did start back again at the bottom and I was no longer shooting things. Now I was loading film.
Right, right.
But it was worth it to kind of at least focus a little bit more on what I wanted to do.
And was that like an IATSE union?
Yeah. Local 600 Camera Guild. But so we had the best incentives in the country for about 5 years. It was up to 42% back. And so I went from working on, you know, a lot of regional commercials, some industrials, the occasional feature that would come in, maybe two features a year and a couple of independent features a year and a bunch of music stuff and a bunch of that, to working on big movie after big movie after big movie after big movie.
Right, because Hollywood was coming out for those incentives.
Yep, Hollywood came to Michigan. And it was great. We built big studios. shows. I met all kinds of high-end people, worked on some really, really high-end jobs, like the remake of Red Dawn, Oz the Great and Powerful, one of the Scream movies we were just talking about earlier.
We were.
And a bunch of great stuff. And then we got a new governor. The first thing the governor did was pull the incentives, and it wasn't – 5 years wasn't enough for the industry of that level to take hold like it has in New Orleans and it has in Atlanta. Without any incentives. Now, if he would have pulled them back, scaled them back to be the same amount that Atlanta has, the same amount that Michigan has, people would probably still be talking about Michigan as a filmmaking destination the way that they were. But as it was, it died, you know, and basically went back to the way that it had been. So at that point, a bunch of people who were really lucky to be coming of age when they did immediately got into the film business. Back in the old days, it was really hard to get in because there weren't that many opportunities. There was a lot of nepotism, you know, a lot of generational stuff happening in Michigan at the time. And then a lot of people moving in from other states, you know, and establishing residency and everything. But when the incentives were pulled, everybody left, right? All these new people left. They're like, yeah, I'm just going to go where the work was. And that's when I decided to leave too. You know, I was like, okay, I'm not going to stay here. I'm not going to go back to the way that it was. And I have all these connections that I didn't have before. Now, given they weren't connections that were going to help me as a writer-director, but they were connections that at least I could go to LA and, you know, make a living.
Yeah, make a living. And not start as a volunteer PA.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
Yep. And also, so the incentives were pulled. I had just graduated from Maymeda College with my MFA in screenwriting. I had made a couple of short films at that point, so I had a little bit of a portfolio. And, yeah, everything lined up, and it was time to come out.
Excellent. Excellent. So in a way that a-hole governor sort of helped guide things along because, I mean, it would have been amazing, God, to think about if Michigan had kept that going and become, yeah, I'm sure at the time they were like Hollywood, that's probably when Vancouver was really big. Remember when all the production was going to Vancouver?
Yeah, yeah.
Clearly to stay in the USA would make things
Vancouver's
easier.
Still big. I actually just lost a job because the DP I work with is doing a job in Vancouver right now. So
Vancouver's still
huge. They're still killing it. Yeah. Yeah, it would have been great. I mean, we had built some, there's always been, so the largest sound stages, in the Midwest are Grace and Wild, because they're huge car stages, right? So now a lot of that work is done digitally, but for years, 70 years, you know, we would actually photograph cars on turntables turning around and sometimes 6, 7, 10 of them on the same sound stage. So there's always been big stages in Detroit. And there's been an infrastructure there. But with the incentives, we ended up building some beautiful, beautiful stages in Pontiac. And that's where we shot Oz the Great and Powerful. And they were
which is
huge.
A cool movie, by the way. I have seen that movie. It's a good movie.
Yeah. I loved it. And it was a great experience to work on too. You know, it was the first 3D and only 3D film that was actually shot in 3D that I've ever worked on. It was just a big effects movie that I hadn't really done before. So it kind of blew my mind on some of the stuff we're doing. But anyway, all that went away, right? And now they build like airplane engines, you know, in the sound stages. And it's just so sad that it was all built and then just all went away.
Yeah. Lack of vision for politics.
It is. It's all politics.
So you ended up coming here.
Yep.
And you had the connections and the experience to get involved in TV production or?
Yeah, that's basically it. So, you know, I'd done a lot of television commercials and things, but there weren't really any television shows that were shot in Michigan. You know, some pilots would come in. I worked on the pilot for The Prince of Motor City, which did not end up going. I worked on the pilot for Low Winter Sun, which did end up going, but I think only lasted a season or something like that. So I had a little bit of television experience. But when I came out here, you know, I just called on all the guys that I'd been working with while the incentives were going or people that would come in to do commercials before that and then started, you know, working in television and kind of worked my way up from being a film loader. I briefly worked as a second, but this was also when we were transitioning from shooting film to shooting digital. So now some things still work on film, but I haven't worked in film in almost 10 years. And I worked my way into being a DIT or a digital imaging technician. I was the DIT on Brooklyn Nine-Nine for all 8 seasons. They played on lots and lots of other shows and just finished up the first season of Grand Crew. And that's kind of what I do for a living now while I'm working on making my own stuff.
The only reason I know what a DIT is you told me before we started recording. you want to tell, give the brief DIT? I bet DIT is a job that even a lot of film people, because like indie film people don't have a DIT right. on set, right?
Right. Well, they have some facsimile of it. So there's different tracks within the camera department. You know, to look at it hierarchically, the cinematographer or director of photography is at the top. Then it kind of splits. And then you have the camera operators on one tier. And under them, you have the first ACs who, you know, pull focus. And then you have the second ACs who basically build the cameras and who slate and who give marks for the actors. And then it kind of comes back down to the loader. And then under that is now a new position we have, which is called the digital utility. The DIT is kind of, well, they're on the same tier as the camera operators. And then going down from there, you would go into the loader. And the loader position used to be the entry-level position, but now it's changed to be the digital utility. And so on independent films, you may not have a DIT, but you'll have a loader who's no longer loading film magazines, but they're downloading the footage. So on big union jobs, you'll have a DIT and you'll have a digital loader. But sometimes a DIT is also downloading the cards if they can't afford it. So that's one thing that the DIT does. But moreover, the DIT is responsible for all the technical aspects of the signal. Right. So we're shooting digitally. We're shooting in logarithmic color profiles, which means that it's going to look really washed out and flat, which gives us more latitude to correct it in post. But nobody on set wants to look at it that way. So that's where the DIT comes in. And we're basically live grading, which means that we're taking this washed out logarithmic signal and turning it into a Rec 709 signal. Basically, we're adding contrast and saturation to it and putting a look on it so that it more approximates what the DP is going for. So that's essentially what it is.
Which is so funny because it's not funny. The thing that's funny is when you talked about it, you reminded me that when you would need to like telecine a film, you would actually do a low contrast print.
Yep.
So that you could do something with it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so what people might not realize is on set, whether it's a film or TV, it's... they're intentionally recording something that doesn't look like what you're going to see.
Yeah. It's yeah. really like if you come from the film ways or you want to look at it on a film paradigm, it's like doing, you know, one light dailies, right? So when you get your actual negative back, it's going to look flat and washed out until you time it, right, in order to bring out the contrast and the saturation.
Yeah.
So that's essentially what we're doing. We're doing one lights on
and,
set.
And it sounds like a really high skill position that you are in the moment live.
Yeah.
Taking this signal, taking this image and making it pretty for people who don't understand any of the technical aspects.
Yeah. I mean, there's lots of cheats, right? So we have LUTs or lookup tables that we can apply that will give us a good start in order to do that. Right. So it's not always starting from scratch on everything. And that is the art of being a DIT. You know, it's primarily a technical position, but when you start getting into the coloring, then it does become artistic, right?
And it's a fascinating thing for you to be involved in as a creative because it's highly technical, but it's also creative. But it's making you pay so much attention to the visual.
Yeah.
That I imagine when you're screenwriting, because now you got an MFA in screenwriting and you're making your own films, that obviously like your mind is sort of evenly divided between the visual and the non.
I don't know if it's evenly divided.
Maybe not evenly.
Right, but I'm certainly thinking about it.
Okay, so nailed. If nailed isn't, if we're not to nailed yet, stop me. But like,
oh, so no, it's,
but like nailed looks much cooler than the average indie. I mean, I don't know how to express it, but I mean, nailed has such a visual style. Definitely has the use of color and the way you lit those sets, you know. Way above that. I don't know how to just really, it looks fantastic.
And thanks,
and
well, I appreciate
really cinematic.
That. Yeah.
And probably, you know, be really hard to pull that off without your background.
Yeah, I think so. You know, it does seem like all of these things are coming together in order to make that film in particular. And I think that it has nailed in particular has to be cinematic or it wouldn't work. I mean, there's no dialogue in the whole film. I mean, there's monologue, if you want to call it that, but there aren't two characters talking directly to each other. Right. So we're really telling the story with visuals. You know, so it's super important to be able to nail those.
It's purely, yeah, it actually, and it plays out. I mean, well, anyway, did you, so you moved to LA and you start working and you work your way up to DIT. So were you making more shorts, or was Nailed one of your earlier efforts?
Yeah, no, I think, what is Nailed? Nailed is 5, 6, something like that. You know, for a while I was making, you know, a short a year. I've kind of fallen off of that pace now through the pandemic. And because I think that I have enough shorts, even though we haven't played like Sundance and Rotterdam, you know, I still feel like I have enough shorts in my portfolio that are on my reel that it's time to really start concentrating on doing bigger things. I've been spending more of my pandemic time, when I haven't been working, you know, working on longer form scripts.
It totally makes sense. I mean, I love the people who make one or two shorts a year and never tire of it. But once you've made 5 or 6 shorts and done the festival circuit 5 or 6 times, like, you really have to ask yourself, am I going to make another short?
Right. Or why are you making the shorts? I mean, if you're making these shorts because that is your bag, you know, and you love it and you like telling short stories, then great, keep doing it. Right. But if you're doing it as a calling card, which I think most people are, you know, at a certain point you have to say, it's time to move on, right? It's time to concentrate. And in today's day and age, you know, the difference financially between making a short and making a feature doesn't have to be that different, right? It's not necessarily that much more expensive to make a feature than it is to make a short. You know, if you're doing it really well on the short and you have an idea that could happen with very few effects, few characters, minimal locations, you know, there's ways to make longer form content that doesn't cost a lot more.
Now, a single location feature, or, you know, a 2 or 3 location feature and a 2 or 3 location short, you are kind of looking at the same beast.
Yeah. Yep. One of the films that I made a couple of years earlier is called, it's a neo-noir detective comedy called Through the Smokescreen, which started out being a short. But when I was working on it, I really loved the characters and I really loved the world that we created, and it's the script just kept getting longer and longer. So it was supposed to be an inception about a 15-minute short, but it ended up being a 30-minute pilot. And it cost about the same as the 5-minute Nailed, right? Even though it's X times longer.
Cool. So Nailed was your last, is your short swan song in a way?
I've actually made another short since then. It's still in post-production. But that was really, I don't expect it to go anywhere. All right. It was something to do during the pandemic, to keep exercising the muscles.
Right.
Right. So it was really more a process-based piece rather than a product.
Right. But it was all kind of calling cardy. I remember the Q&A for Nailed. We talked about Jean-Pierre Jeunet.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, Delicatessen and whatnot. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the inspirations. And so, yeah, it sounds like you're very comedy-focused.
Well,
is that not true?
From the stuff that you've seen.
Right.
Now, I tend to, and I know this is terrible for branding myself as a filmmaker, but I tend to write whatever I want. And looking back at my catalog, I tend to do a drama, a comedy. But I will say that I get the best response from my comedies. But I don't know that means I'm a better comedy writer. I just think that it's easier to do comedy in the short form. It's really hard to do drama in the short form successfully. And there's tricks that you can use, certain subject matter. There's a lot of things that are topical that trigger people. It'll get you into a lot of festivals, you know, if you're willing to make this stuff. But that's not me. You know, I'm not that kind of a drama writer. Right. And so I think that when I get to make longer form dramas, I think they'll be more successful. But if I'm still making short stuff, I think comedy is what I'll concentrate on.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to disagree with you about the ease of comedy. if I ever pulled you onto a selection jury of a film festival, you'd realize comedy is probably harder. Most people fail at comedy. Like, it's really hard to actually be funny. So kudos to you for making things that actually are funny.
Yeah, hire the right actors.
But I totally get what you're saying is drama, if you're... Drama requires investment in characters that you may not be able to pull off in 5 to 7 minutes.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
You have to, there's no character development in short films, right?
No.
Or if there is, it's very, very hard to do quickly, right? Whereas comedy, it's, if you structure it right, it's there, right? And there's time to do it, you know, set up punchline.
You have a guy with a mustache and a hammer. And like, we already know what you want us to know about him.
Yeah. That's all you need to know.
Yeah. Whereas Yeah. Whereas drama, yeah, you have to pull on heartstrings and things people have already seen. You have to have
Oh, people have cried watching Nailed.
Have they really, though?
Me.
Oh, do you?
No,
Are you a self-critic or no?
Well, I mean, I'm critical of the work, but I don't think I'm critical of myself.
Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah, right. Right. Critical of the work. Sure. Well, Nailed is fun, though.
But yeah, I think so. Hopefully. Yeah.
For sure. For sure. In fact, it's hilarious.
Thanks.
It's funny to meet you and get a sense of you because, like, Nailed, in a lot of ways, Nailed feels somewhat insane. Like, in a good way. I say that in a good way.
Right, right.
And I've actually noticed this thing talking to people on the podcast and at film festivals, and you really never know.
Like, who you're going to get.
Who,
like,
you're going to get.
Yeah, because, right, sure.
Because there will be, like, perfectly, for lack of a better word, perfectly rational films where the filmmaker is actually completely insane. And then, like, I'm sorry, but the maker of Nailed could have, like, showed up at the festival or showed up and been completely out of left field, right? Like, could have been, like, a super eccentric, crazy person.
Right.
And yet, you seem completely not like that.
Well, it reminds me of I'm going to paraphrase, but it's a David Cronenberg quote. And, you know, I don't remember what festival it was, but let's call it Toronto. He's Canadian, right? So he's at a festival and somebody comes up and says, like, wow, you know, when I first learned about you, I thought you would be just this crazy, morose, all dressed in black guy, you know, that makes all this body horror stuff. And his response was something like, yeah, I live very simply and very normally so that all the strangeness comes out in the work.
Fair enough. Huh? Fair enough. I get it. So you let your absurd side come out in the work.
Yeah. Then I don't have to live absurdly in my own life.
Excellent. And do you enjoy it, but obviously you enjoy absurdist comedy.
I do. Yeah. But I think there's a limit too. Like, you know, I grew up on the Marx Brothers and the Stooges. But I think that there is a line in my own work that I don't want to cross. You know, I think that, like, absurdist, sure. But, like, I'm not slapstick.
No.
Right? I think there's a certain level that I'll go to.
For sure. And we talked about other influences. Although that was 2 years ago.
Right, yeah.
So I only remember the one because I'm a huge fan of
yeah, great. Yeah,
Genet.
Genet is certainly still the major influence for Nailed.
Yeah, for sure. All right, so since Nailed, well, so you had, did you get any in-person experiences with Nailed?
Yeah, like, yeah,
you,
we
you
did.
Got to yeah. do some in-person festivals?
Yep. And it was good, you know. I mean, we were in the Burbank Film Festival. We were in person, the Scene Film Festival in Providence, Rhode Island. That also went in person. We're in the San Diego Film Festival that went in person. We were in the Globe Screen Film Festival that went in person in London during the pandemic. And we were just blown away that they actually decided to do it. And apparently they got a really good turnout as well. But we weren't able, even though the festival in person, we didn't go because we couldn't even get on a plane, you know.
Yeah, that would have been really tricky.
Yeah.
And, well, I'm trying to even conceive of that. During the pandemic,
yep.
they held an event in London.
Yep.
Well, I don't even remember now what was going on. Yeah, but I remember there was a time when London, like, because of Boris or whatever, they were in denial.
Yeah.
About it. They were sort of being extra Trumpy.
Yes. That's a great way to put it. And two, I mean, over the 2 years of the pandemic or however long it's been, you know, there's been peaks, right, and arcs, and some things have opened up for little periods of time and then closed, especially in different places. So it was just one of those things that were like, yeah, we can do it. We're going to do it. And they actually got a bunch of people from London. But for filmmakers, it was terrible for us because we couldn't go, you know.
Yeah, yeah, and flying and traveling and staying in hotels, you just have
yeah.
to...
Yeah, look, there's no way we could... I mean, we've had to, like, charter a boat or something, you know, because we couldn't get on an airplane.
Yeah, you're talking pre-vaccine. It's funny.
Yeah.
We've had vaccines almost as long, you know, for more than half of this thing now.
Yeah.
So it's weird to think what it was like that first year when you had no protection against it.
Right.
And nobody knew where
things were going or what was going to happen, you know.
Yeah. Still very cool to say that you screened in London.
Yeah. We won an award, too. It was like best comedy.
Woo. Excellent. Excellent.
Best short comedy, I should say.
Yeah. And so since then, are you focused on a feature now?
Yeah. Like? Yep. So building on Through the Smokescreen, my neo-noir detective comedy, I'm writing another detective comedy, but it's inspired by, but it's completely different characters. It's really kind of taking everything that I learned with that project and then putting it into a new piece. Whereas that was a pilot, this one is a feature. So over the last couple of years, you know, since television has been going crazy, I've been writing pilots and haven't been getting any traction with them, even though I work in television, which is weird, like working in the camera department in television. It's like I'm so close, but I'm so far, right? We so get pigeonholed in this.
Right, business. Because they could give a shit about the script written by the DIT.
Exactly. That's it, exactly, right? Yeah. And it's even inappropriate to pitch it, you know? I mean, you can't really go up to the directors or the showrunners or even any of the writers that come on set and be like, hey, have you thought about this? Here, look at this, you know? It's just, you'll get thrown out, you know?
Yeah, or you won't be invited back.
Yep.
Yeah, for sure.
So
for
it's
sure.
really, it's it can be really frustrating being in that position where like you're so close, but you're so far. But anyway, so after having written a couple of pilots that I think are pretty good, and I've never written anything that I've really put out into festivals as screenplays, you know, or any screenplay contest or anything, because I've always wanted to just do it myself. Right. And I've never really thought of myself as a writer who needs to like get staffed as a writer's assistant in a writer's room and work his way up, you know, doing that kind of stuff. I already work in the film business, and I don't need to start over at this point in my career, doing things that I don't really want to do. Right. So I really want to concentrating on writing stuff that I'm going to make. But also in television, it's really hard to get somebody to fund that kind of stuff because it always, you know, it's so rare that somebody's going to buy a spec from somebody outside. You know, if you're in a room, it's much easier to, you know, if you have representation because you've done something else, it's easier. So after writing a couple of things that I believed in but haven't been able to get made, I've decided to switch back to writing features again. I really realize that it's much easier to independently fund features than it is to independently fund television.
Yeah, which is interesting. I think you're 100% correct. And at the same time, when I think about it, if only people understood, like the money raised for a feature, like at this point you could shoot 6 or 8 episodes of something and then pitch it to cable and streaming because there's so many avenues for that.
Well, people don't really think that way. As far as I know, like the only self-funded and shot pilot that's ever been picked up by network television is It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Right. Other than that, it's been script pickups where they shot it themselves.
Yeah. I mean, a bit of the YouTube series that got sucked in. I think Broad like, City kind of did
maybe,
it.
Maybe, yeah.
But yeah,
that's
not
a little not like just like straight network production. Right. So it's a hard bet. Right. If you want to spend your money on making a pilot, the odds are the network isn't going to look at it. And if they do, the odds of them actually buying it and greenlighting your series based on that is really, really, really small. However, if you can set yourself up as an independent filmmaker who is, you know, selling product, who's getting into festivals, you know, who's getting distribution and making a name for yourself, and then you want to cross over, I think it's much easier to do it that way. But maybe not easier isn't the right word, but it's much more probable that you'll have success with that model.
For sure. And it definitely seems like I see a lot of director names on TV episodes,
right?
Who I know from the festival, not know personally,
right?
Who I know were making indie features 5, 10 years ago.
Yeah. Well, if you think about it from a financial standpoint, if you are funding, you have a bunch of money, independently wealthy, you work for Netflix, and you want to put it into a production. Are you going to put it into a feature or are you going to put it into a television pilot? If you put it into a television pilot, there really isn't any way that you can make your money back on it. I mean, maybe you can put it up on YouTube and like get some ad money on it or something. Whereas if you put the same amount or maybe a little bit more into a feature, you can actually get distribution for the feature and make your money back, hopefully. At least theoretically, the model makes sense, right? At least there's an avenue for it, right? Shorts, you're never going to make your money on it. A television pilot, how are you going to make your money on it? But with an independent feature, it just goes back to the old model that we've been working with since, you know, Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
Right? Yeah. And actually the model does exist. There might be a small number of people who will pay. Well, there actually are probably a lot of people who will still pay a rental fee for a feature.
Right.
But they're not going to, everyone, television has always been free.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's always been ad supported.
Yeah. Ad supported. Right.
Yeah. So no one ever goes on Amazon. It's hard for me to go on Amazon. And this is someone who has you know, is producing a TV series that's an anthology of indie shorts.
Right.
And it's like, it's a big ask to say pay to watch TV.
Yep.
Yeah. It's a shame.
Right. Well, and you can't sell it, right? I mean, no, you can sell the distribution rights on a feature, right? You could sell it to Amazon. You could sell it to Netflix. Or you could sell it to, you know, a theatrical distributor. Or you could sell the foreign rights. You know, I mean, there's a lot that you could do. Lots of ancillary markets and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Because film still has...
It still has value as IP.
Value, yeah. For sure. Well, it makes sense. And I like that you're doing detective noir comedy.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, I mean, detective-based comedy has always been... I mean, you make me think of Peter Sellers. And
Oh, yeah.
You make me think of Dudley Moore and Peter Cook. And
yep.
I've always seen lots of fantastic detective-based comedy.
Great. Yeah. Well, if you want to check it out, it's called Through the Smokescreen. It's on my website at distortionfield.tv. You want to check it out?
For sure. I'll look at it.
Yeah. But I did learn a lot about making that and about what works and what doesn't. So it's in black and white, you know, as all good noir detective stories are. But it's hard to sell, you know, black and white. I didn't realize that so many people would be turned off just because it's in black and white. I think if, you know, I was making, so people are doing it, you know, Roma came out, it was in black and white. I mean, there's been some other black and white films in the last couple of years. But those were all made by well-known people who were going to see it regardless. But I was surprised, you know, to learn how many people were immediately turned off by just black and white. There's a lot of esoteric jokes in there, that I was surprised. I mean, there's a Casablanca joke in there that half the audience didn't get. And I was like, you've never seen Casablanca? I was just blown away. And people that call themselves filmmakers, you know, I had no idea. You know, I thought that, you know, if you're going to make films, if you're going to be a film critic, you would at least have to know, you know, here's looking at you, kid. Yeah.
I would think so, especially that line. They may not even know that's a Casablanca line, but you should know it.
Yep.
And you got this from showing it to people?
From showing it to people, from feedback, you know, from watching it with audiences.
Did you do the festival circuit with it or?
I submitted it to like Sundance, Slam Dance, and like three other, like Tribeca, you know, and I didn't get into anything of that nature. And I think a lot of it was because it's half an hour. You know, really hard to program something that long with no stars in it that's black and white and esoteric.
Do they have like a pilot section or they don't?
The New York Festival does. Yeah, I submitted it as a short, which may have been a problem, you know. And also like I said, I only submitted it to like five festivals and they were all big festivals. So it might have been a mistake. But I just didn't feel that it was worth it on that one, you know, to go.
Yeah, it's not a mistake. You swung for the fences a little. You're like, well, if I'm going to pay a submission fee, it'll be for the big guys.
Yeah.
But you don't need to, I mean.
Well, I didn't think that the smaller festivals could do anything for it because, I mean, in one sense, like with a short, even if it isn't a film market, you still have value with networking and getting it out there. And then maybe somebody will see it and it could go someplace. But like with something that ultimately was a television pilot. Oh yeah. So I should say too, that it wasn't intended to be a serial when we were first writing it, but I call it a pilot because at the end we slapped up Dick Regan will return in the next episode of just as a joke, just because so many of the things of the era did end that way. And then one of the biggest points of feedback that I got when I was showing it to people, one of the biggest comments was, so when's the next episode coming out? Right. So people really were excited to see it. And so I was like, yeah, it really could be exist as a pilot. But like we were talking earlier, what good will come of taking a pilot on the festival circuit? Because there's nobody there.
Just if you need your ego boosted.
Right. I guess, right.
Which, you know, but honestly, the festival circuit is really only good for ego boosts anyway, right? I mean, and networking, but...
Yeah.
But really networking among people, I mean, I don't even... I hear all the time now that even getting into Sundance really doesn't change a life anymore.
Yeah, no. What was it? I was just yesterday reading the... It was... 10,400 shorts that were submitted to Sundance in the last season.
Yeah.
10,000.
And I don't know how many they showed that they went all virtual again.
Yeah.
But,
probably 50 or something like
but
that.
But I can't name the last time, you know, the last Sundance film that sort of made an impact, I think might be Little Miss Sunshine.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's one since then.
That was a decade ago.
Yeah. It was forever ago. I mean, you know, I know a lot of people who are like, yeah, my film played at Sundance and it was a great experience. And I went home and my life was completely unchanged.
Yeah. The last Sundance film that I paid attention to was Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
Well.
Kidding.
Yeah, that was an important film. And I believe that would have been in 1989.
Yeah. But no, I'm just kidding. I know.
Heck, you were just a kid. You were still in high school, I bet.
I was. Yeah.
That was a college movie for me.
Oh, you're so much older.
No, not that much, but it was, I went to see that alone, actually, because I was just so interested.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just reading about Soderbergh's journey to making that film. It was pretty interesting. It's worth checking out online. I can't remember what magazine it was in, but I'm sure you could find it.
I almost brought him up earlier because you were talking about yourself and your interests and that you're not devoted to one genre and you're not devoted to one style, and he might be the prototype of that or the archetype of that, that I've even heard him
say.
One
for them, one for me.
Yeah. Like, but also he'd be, because he wants to do a heist movie and then he wants to do something completely different. And they're like, when you actually, I think he's, I've heard him say, you don't look at a film and know it's mine. I actually think I do recognize him.
Yeah, I think I would too.
But it's, he's not like a Paul Thomas Anderson or a Tarantino where,
or
like
Wes
the
Anderson.
Style is so over the top, you know exactly. He's doing arguably similar vibe over and over. Yeah. Like he's just completely
Well, he's certainly an influence. And I think that some of his work is fantastic and some of it's terrible. But I think that that's, you know, Part of his.
It's funny, I can't name the terrible stuff, but
Schizopolis.
Oh, you're anti-Schizopolis.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of Schizopolis.
Really?
I think he's particularly funny, his performance.
I might have to go and watch it again, but I didn't really like it. There was the one with all the doll heads. What was that? That was pretty pretty low budget.
I didn't watch The Nick.
I thought The Nick was great.
Oh, you saw The
Nick? Yeah, it was really good. Interesting side note, the second film I ever worked on is a production assistant was out of sight when it was shooting in Detroit. So I got like my 2 weeks with Soderbergh early on in my career.
And I believe that's the one that broke him and made him quit for a while.
No, that's what made,
that's
sent him
out. When he came back.
No. After that he did The Limey and then.
Right.
You know,
I'm thinking of there was the Peter Gallagher one that he made and then he's like, oh, I'm going to walk away from film for a while and then Schizopolis, but.
Oh, yeah.
I'm blanking on it. But, like, he's like, why am I making that? I'm making a film just for the paycheck, and why bother?
Yeah. No, that was before. So he's left a couple times.
Yeah.
Right, because then he said he's only going to do television, but then he came back with that heist movie. So not afraid to walk away, for sure.
No, does what he feels like, which is admirable.
Yeah. But he's made some great films. Like, The Limey is one of my favorites. Out of Sight is the cutting in it. It's just fantastic.
And all very diverse. Yeah, no, we could praise him for a while, but we're supposed to be talking about you. But it's cool. But I can tell he's an influence. You got good influences.
Yeah.
All right. So cool. What else? That's well. I kind of feel like we're nearing wrap up time.
Yeah.
We can do your four questions, but
if you like.
You mentioned your website and stuff for people to. You want to say the website address and all that?
It's distortionfield.tv is the maiden website, and that'll link you to a bunch of the work that I've done recently. Some upcoming projects are on there, a documentary. I don't have anything about the new script up there, but I'm sure I will once we get closer to production. But definitely you can watch through the smokescreen there.
And is there social media?
I would have to look up what all of it is.
And my laughter is because Nicholas and I discuss social media before we start recording and what a motherfucking pain in the ass it can be. Or it just doesn't feel natural. Maybe it's just because it's just not natural to us.
Yeah.
It came too late in our lives to feel like.
Or we express ourselves through the work, right? And we don't need to express ourselves through the social media.
For sure. At which I'm going to follow up with, I'm about to name all the social media handles that people can check out. Distortionfield.tv is Nicholas's website, so people should check it out. Now I'm going to talk about discoveryindiefilm.com.
Yeah.
Because that's where people can learn all about this podcast and the TV series. And let me grade Grub for a second. If you're listening to this, subscribe, follow, like, rate, 5 stars. And we mentioned the TV series that Nicholas's film Nailed is in. It's in season 4, episode 3. That's on Amazon Prime Video. So just go to Prime Video any way you can get to it. Although don't watch movies on your phone.
Please don't watch movies on your phone.
Don't watch movies. Although there's a 14-year-old in this house who will like sit in the room with right the 55-inch TV, and she's watching Netflix on her phone.
Oh, man.
In the room with the big TV. Bigger TV. Anyway, I'll stop whining about that. But ask for also, hey, you know what? Go to season 4. Shell out a little bit of money to watch Nicholas's film and the whole season if you want. And then give that 5 stars, you know? Give the TV series 5 stars. Amusingly, we don't... I think we have, in the 4 seasons, nearly 100 filmmakers involved. And we don't have 105 star reviews anywhere. So, what are you going to do? But that's discoveryindiefilm.com. And then the social media for Discovery Indie Film is at DIF Wins, which is actually there's a fun story behind that I will never tell. Because if you weren't there, it won't be funny. But it's at DIF for Discovery Indie Film Wins. And we talked about that Nailed was at Filmvasion Los Angeles. That's a festival that happens every June. You can learn about it at filmvasionla.com. And on social media, it's at filmvasionla. And there is a sister festival every November, the Sherman Oaks Film Festival. And that's shermanoaksff.com. And it's at shermanoaksff on social media. Very proud of both of those to say that at this moment, both are in the top 100 best-reviewed festivals on Film Freeway, which filmfreeway.com is where... They just killed everybody. Like, that's the only submission platform at this point. They did it by being good, at least. Not by being, Lord knows, the predecessor. The one... why am I blanking?
Without a Box.
Without a Box was so hard to use. And
all standard definition submissions.
Oh, just... yeah, Film Freeway came along and made Without a Box irrelevant. So it's made our lives better. Now let's just hope they don't start jacking up the rates like crazy. All right. Well, I'm going to thank Nicholas for coming in person.
You. Yeah.
We're healthy, but we're talking in person. But there's like a 5-foot table, so we almost have enough distance between us. And thank you, everyone, for listening.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.